Napa know-how.
It takes a lot to get excited about a bag, but most bags can't save you 20% on auto parts. That's 20% off headlamps, 20% off oil filters, 20% off virtually anything you can fit inside the 99-cent Napa reusable bag. So tell your buddies, there's a bag they just have to check out. Quality parts, helpful people. That's Napa know-how.
Napa know-how.
At participating Napa Auto Parts stores while supplies last. Minimum three items. Exclusions apply. Offer ends 10/31/17.
Hello there. Welcome to Locked On Heat. Today is a crossover episode between Locked On Heat and Locked On Thunder. I'm actually not in the show. This is David Ramil with the host of Locked On Thunder, Fred Katz. He's great. You'll really enjoy him talking about the Oklahoma City Thunder, talking about the upcoming game between the Heat and Thunder, previewing that matchup. So listen to that. Subscribe to Locked On Heat on iTunes. Rate us, review us, say nice things about us, because it really helps our rating in iTunes and it helps other people discover us. So we'd appreciate it. Now enjoy the episode. This is Locked On Heat. Thank you.
You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team every day.
Hello there, everyone. We're locked in for episode 78 of Locked On Thunder, presented by the Norman Transcript. David, remind me again how I pronounce your last name. Is it
Ramil rhymes with Hill? That's how I always say it.
Ramil. Yeah. Okay, got it. Okay, sorry about that. I just wanted to make sure I got it right. Hello there, everyone. We're locked in for episode 78 of Locked On Thunder, presented by the Norman Transcript. I'm your host, Fred Katz. Locked On Thunder is part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Head on to iTunes and search Locked On Thunder to subscribe to the podcast there. And you can find us on Audioboom, and you can leave a review once you're on the iTunes page also. And you can log on to normantranscript.com to check out my blog, Thunder Road. It's under the sports tab on the site on normantranscript.com. And you can check out all my Thunder coverage there. Preview up there now of the Monday game against the Miami Heat with the return of the magnificent, the beloved Dion Waiters on every day of the week. Obviously, Monday through Friday, first show of the week. And leading us off for the Heat game, Locked On Heat host, Locked On Heat co-host with Wes Goldberg, David Ramil. David, what's up?
How you doing, Fred? Doing well.
I'm good. I am ready for some Dion Waiters.
Yeah. Unlike most of the Miami Heat fan base, I think at this point they're not quite sure how to handle the Waiters experience. But I'm trying to tell them it's more of a marathon than a sprint, and they have to just be able to adjust accordingly, because it's as you well know, it's a lot to deal with.
So I know that we have a lot to talk about. Russell Westbrook and sustainable starts and Steven Adams and the rest of the supporting cast around Westbrook and Goran Dragic and the changes with the Heat and a lot of stuff. But can we lead with Dion Waiters?
Oh, of course. You know, I'm always willing to talk Dion Waiters with everybody. I've been a longtime fan of his. Well, I don't know how long time considering his career is so short, but I was Wes and I actually led the charge to add Waiters to the team. We started calling, a campaign Waiters Peninsula to bring him to Miami. And then weeks later, sure enough, they did add him. So I don't know if Pat Riley and company are listening to the Locked On Heat podcast, but I'd like to think that I had a hand in bringing Dion to Miami. So,
hey, just keep telling yourself it. If you keep telling yourself it, then it's going to become true sooner rather than later.
Absolutely.
So tell me, Dion threw five games, shooting about 35% from the field. He started all five games. Josh Richardson started the season hurt with MCL injury, right?
Correct.
Dion now, in flux with his exact positioning at the team. Give me a little taste of what he's been like so far through five games.
Well, as you and I talked about early in the start of the preseason, I think, we expected him to fill more of a six-man role similar to what he did in Oklahoma City. But with the Richardson injury, he's been thrust in the starting lineup, and he's had the ball in his hands a lot. He's missed a lot of shots. He was actually shooting much better from three-point range than he is from two-point range, missing a lot of shots in the rim. He says that he's not getting the amount of free throws as you can expect that he thinks so, that he deserves to get. He's getting fouled, in his words, a lot and not getting the calls. So there's been some frustration there from Heat fans that see him kind of lay up these shots that don't really have any chance of going in, expecting a foul call and not getting that call. So there's been a little frustration. There was also a play against, I want to say, not Sacramento. It might have been, yes, it might have been against the Sacramento Kings facing overtime or going into the end of regular season, regular time there. He had the ball in his hands, put up a long contested three-pointer as time eclipsed. It was not a good introduction to the Waiters experience for a lot of Heat fans. So it's been, as you can expect, erratic, solid at times. You liked his ability to create shots for others. He is doing that at a pretty decent rate. He's having a lot of defenders collapse on him as he drives to the rim. And that's, I think, a lot of what the Heat fans in general aren't seeing. But, you know, since the shots aren't following, I think that's the easiest part to break down and not like about Deion's game. So that's been the complaint so far.
I wonder what the Thunder fans' reaction is going to be to him. Like, if he's in the starting lineup on Monday night and they announce his name with the Miami starters, like, I wonder what the reaction is going to be in Oklahoma City. They're not going to boo him, but I wonder like what the reaction is going to be. Like, if it's going to be a sustained cheer, or if like it's just going to kind of be like some people cheering and most people just kind of treating him like a normal road player.
Yeah, I mean, I don't. The year and a half he was there, he wasn't really responsible for a lot of their success anyway. So, I mean, I think he did play fairly well during that time span. So, you know, he had his moments, obviously, as Deion is wont to do. And there's no reason for them to dislike him, as you pointed out. So I'm hopeful that they'll cheer him loudly because, you know, that'll make him feel better. And anything that makes Deion feel good makes me feel good.
I love interviewing Deion Waiters.
Yeah.
I'm excited to interview him tomorrow.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah, he's great. Look, I saw him a couple of days ago when he was facing the season opener against the Orlando Magic. Did look a little surly, I'll be honest with you. So tread lightly with Deion.
It's okay. Deion and I are cool. Deion has he always says something funny whenever I ask him a question. I feel like he always says something funny. So I always end up smiling whenever I talk to that guy. So he makes me happy. So I'm happy to talk to him. You want to talk about some other more consequential players in this game?
Yeah, I mean, I think.
If there are any, of course.
Well, I mean, not in the grand scheme of things, but I guess in the minutia of a game-to-game basis, I guess a lot of people would look at Russell Westbrook as being a somewhat interesting figure out on the floor. You know, obviously this is quote-unquote his team now. You know, he gets to direct a lot of what Oklahoma City does. And so I think from the Miami Heat fan perspective, you know, obviously they had the context of Kevin Durant and Russell Westbrook leading that team for so long. And now that's changed dramatically as the narrative has in Miami as well, now that Dwayne Wade and others have gone. So how is it that Oklahoma City is performing at such a high level early in the season?
You know, it's really been the defense. I mean, there's a lot of talk, obviously, about the numbers that Russell Westbrook is putting up, and they're crazy. I mean, he's averaging like 33, 10, and 9. And you know, for the amount of shots that he's putting up, he's shooting a ton. But for the amount of shots that he's putting up, he's actually been pretty efficient. Like, his true shooting percentage is higher than league average. So it's not like he's been chucking these shots with terrible inefficiency. Like, he's been above average efficiency as his usage has climbed, which is pretty rare. Those two stats are supposed to have an inverse relationship, not one. You don't usually see them both go up, you know, at the same time. Mm-hmm. But the offense has not been good. I mean, this is a team, it's a defense or an offense that I believe is, you know, bottom five, bottom seven in the league right now in terms of offensive efficiency, but they've been winning on defense. I mean, it's been consistently top 10 since the season started, obviously early. Obviously a small sample size. They played some teams that they are certainly better than, or at least should be certainly better than. I mean, they played some bottom feeders, you know, Phoenix, Philadelphia, the Lakers, although the Lakers just beat up on the Warriors and look like, I don't think they'll be good, but they look like they're going to be definitely a lot better than they were last year when they won 17 games.
Well, that's not saying much, right?
Yes, that's true. But they might not be a pushover is all right. I'm saying.
No, absolutely.
But they beat the Lakers. They beat Phoenix. They beat Philadelphia. They beat Minnesota, who's gotten off to a slow start. They did have a really good win out in Los Angeles, beating the Clippers on the road. I mean, that's a great win. That's you know, one of the three or four best teams in the NBA, in my opinion. And they, you know, that Clippers team just won by 20-some-odd points in San Antonio. And the Thunder held them to, to 83 points in a home win, and that's a really good offense, even if it has struggled a little bit early. The Thunder just had a great defensive performance. The defense has just been stifling. Adams has been great. Andre Roberson is having a ridiculous defensive start to the season. He looks like an all-defense guy with the way that he's defending. Now they got Jeremy Grant, who, you know, really is not any a shooter by any stretch, no pun intended. But he's an active defender, and he's long, and he's athletic, and he's another guy to add to the mix. And Oladipo's been solid on the ball, and while Westbrook still has some of his flaws, he's been better than he was last season on the defensive end when I thought he had, you know, a down defensive year. So this is a defense it's looked a lot better than it did last regular season. It's kind of carried over some of the momentum that it built up during the postseason last year. And it's interesting because in the past, the Thunder have won with a lot of offense, and they've been good defensively. Sure. But, you know, their firepower has been having Durant and Westbrook on the offensive end. You need a bucket, you're going to get a bucket. You've got two of the five or six best players in the NBA. And now the offense is really stifling because there's not a lot of shooting. And the defense is stifling. And it's an interesting switch in identity.
Yeah, that is. Because, I mean, obviously, nobody really – I think, you know, everybody knows that Westbrook has his faults defensively, and he's the face of the team, so you don't expect them to be a solid defensive team. Although, as you pointed out, they were really good in the past. I mean, I think they – during that run there over the last 5 or 6 years, I think they were amongst the top 10 teams as far as offense and defense on a regular basis, on an annual basis. And I think that's impressive that they've been able to sustain that. So it's not that surprising, I guess. Steven Adams is a pretty solid plus defender, I'd say. Oladipo has always been known for his defense, even if his offense is a little erratic. So there's definitely been some encouraging signs there for Thunder fans.
Yeah, and Roberson, I really do think, is an underrated defensive player.
Absolutely.
He's become an excellent perimeter defender. He can guard 1-2s and 3s. If you know you're a stretch 4, if you're kind of like the 3 that plays the 4, he can guard that kind of guy too. Jeremy Grant has helped, who they just got and has played 3 games with them. They've got guys who can defend. I mean, they don't have a ton of plus defenders, honestly, but they have a bunch of guys who are so good defensively, like Roberson, like Adams. Those guys who are so good defensively that they can make the impact on defense. That can push them toward being a very solid defense. I don't know if they're a top 3 or 4 defense. I don't think they finish in that, you know, quite that high. But I do think they're going to be a good defense, and I do think they're going to make a lot of games look real messy, and that's going to take them to a decent amount of wins this year.
Is this a style of play that you appreciate more than maybe the trading off of shots, the kind of style that they embody, at least offensively, being that the predominant way of defining that team over the last few years? Is this something a little bit more grinding it out, a little uglier winning than maybe the style of play that they had over the last couple of seasons?
Well, define appreciate.
Obviously not aesthetically, right? But, I mean, as long as they're grinding out these wins, does it feel more, I don't know, organic, wholesome maybe? That's exactly what I'm not exactly what I'm looking for, but I think along those realms there. Because I guess there was always mounting frustration there, at least from what I've seen from Thunder fans, in that you knew that this team was always going to be capable of eking out those victories because of the respective strengths of Westbrook and Durant. Now that Durant's gone and so much of the narrative surrounding Westbrook and his ownership of the team – now that the style of play has changed, do you feel, I don't know, a little bit more closely attached to it?
No.
No? Yeah. No, you still prefer the former
really.
Style of play?
I mean, if you have a chance to see one of the best players in the NBA or not see one of the best players in the NBA, I'll take seeing one of the best players in the NBA. I mean, look, stylistically, they honestly haven't. It's not like the ball has been fizzing around. It's not like they've been playing, you know, like the 2014 Spurs, just you know, 12 passes, you know, in 8 seconds, and just, you know, playing hot potato with the basketball. That really hasn't been the case. Look, I think when people use total passes, that SportView stat that just tracks total passes within an offense, people like to use that to show how good your ball movement is on offense. And it's a crappy stat to use for that. It's not an indicator of how good your offense is. The Thunder were last in total passes last year, and they had the most efficient non-Warriors offense in the NBA in 4 years. So this is not it's just not indicative of good offense. You know, Toronto is there at the bottom of the league now this year, and they were around there last year, and that's a top 10 offense. And there are other ones that are really highly ranked offenses that are really low on that list. And and there are ones that are really, really highly and there are really lowly ranked offenses that are really high on that total passes list too. But what it is indicative in some ways is it's indicative of just your style. Right. Projecting no actual judgment onto that style. It's just indicative of the style. And the Thunder is still like bottom five in total passes. So it's not like the ball is being thrown around like crazy and they're passing a ton. I mean, Russell Westbrook is still dominating the ball.
Mm-hmm.
He's not being selfish in dominating the ball. That's kind of, you know, every once in a while he'll take a bad shot because that's, you know, Russell Westbrook. But, you know, you'd rather Russell Westbrook have the ball than Kyle Singler or Anthony Morrow or another guy on this team who could score. So you know, he needs to have the ball, and he's dominating it a lot. A lot of his passes are leading to assists. They're not necessarily leading to ball movement because he's having the ball, and he's pounding the air out of it when he's dribbling. And it's not necessarily the wrong thing. I do think that's how you have to approach it when you have Russell Westbrook. But
right.
It's not like they've been playing this incredible ball movement style of offense now that Kevin Durant's gone.
And it's always – I found it interesting, and I've seen a lot of blowback recently, you know, now that we expected Westbrook to kind of be dominant as he has been in the past, but at least he had Durant there to kind of complement that style and help share some of the load. But now that it's almost exclusively Westbrook's team, I've seen a lot of feedback about, you know, the difference in perception regarding Westbrook and a guy like, say, Kobe Bryant towards the end of his career. And how do you deal with that being a journalist that covers the team on a regular basis? I mean, I've always appreciated Westbrook and his approach, but I know that a lot of people tend to think of it as being, oh, I don't know. I mean, obviously, selfish is a word that gets traded around a lot in the narrative about, you know, how Westbrook dominates or hogs the ball. That would seem to be very frustrating from somebody who covers the team and sees them as closely as you do. How do you feel about Westbrook and his ball dominance, whether it's positive or negative? And that's, feel free to ascribe judgment to it if you like.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, if it's something that hurts the team, then that's something you have to report on. If it's something that hurts the team, then you don't have to interject your opinion into it and say, oh, I don't like that this guy is dribbling too much. You find numbers, or you find quotes, or you find maybe people who will speak non-biasedly about it. You know, not necessarily, you know, maybe people in the organization say something.
Sure.
Or but maybe more realistically, you find people in other organizations who say, that's not the way they should play, or whatever it is. I don't think that's the case, though.
Right.
I don't think it is hurting them. I mean, look, he's having a fantastic year. Like he has a 56% true shooting percentage. And I mean, that's not peak Miami LeBron when he was like, you know, a 64% true shooter and like coming close to leading the league in that category on a ridiculous volume. But like it is above league average. And considering his usage is literally at a number that would be the highest regular season usage of all time right now, the fact that he's doing it in above average efficiency means he's taking an offense that is already a below average one, at least propping it up past like worst in the league. I think people get carried away because when we're young and we play basketball, people tell us not to hog the ball, right? Like
sure.
That's the term they use. Don't hog the ball. You're being a bad teammate. At this level though, like at the NBA level and at levels below it, but specifically at the NBA level, because that's what we're talking about. Like it's not being a bad teammate. I will use the term hog the ball because I think we need to get rid of the stigma of that verb hog the ball. Like, because hogging the ball is not bad when you are by far the best option to have the ball on your team. Like, it's not necessarily selfish. Like, one thing that I was talking about with someone recently is that, like, Steven Adams is so modest that he's always he's never been, like, a high usage scorer on his team.
Right.
And Steven Adams has gotten so good now that in order for his team to hit its offensive peak, he needs to shoot more and he needs to be a more aggressive scorer. And I don't know if we'll get to that point, but he needs to be a more aggressive scorer because for the first time in his professional basketball playing life of 4 years now, Steven Adams putting up shots at a high volume is actually the best thing for his offense, his team's offense, because he's that good of an offensive player. It's not – Steven Adams doesn't have to become more selfish. He just needs to realize that him taking more shots is actually the unselfish thing. And I think that's the case for Russell Westbrook. Like, look, he's going to take shots that are bad shots. Of course he is. He's Russell Westbrook. Every once in a while, he took 44 shots against Phoenix. 15 of those were mid-range shots. Like, Tyson Chandler was just zoning up the pick and roll and goading him into mid-range shots, and he was taking them, and he missed a bunch of them. And, like, he's going to take those pull-up threes with time left on the shot clock when he could go to the rim or creating something, and, like, he's going to take those shots. But just because those are, like, really obvious flaws, that doesn't mean he needs to give the ball up, you know, more on the whole or change a style. Like, that style is what makes him so good, you know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I'm glad you bring up Adams, because he's an interesting case there. I think from a lot of Heat fans' perspective that maybe don't watch the Thunder as much, you're seeing his name in the news recently. He got a 4-year extension worth about $100 million. I'm not sure if the exact amount was ever accurately
reported. Yep, that's it. Four for 100.
Okay. And a lot of people might think, well, he doesn't really score much. He doesn't really do much. How is he getting the kind of salary that, you know, Hassan Whiteside is getting or was awarded this past offseason when he signed a free agent contract with the Heat? So, you know, I think you're probably best equipped to explain Adams' overall impact. But, I mean, I've seen him play. I think he's a really great passer. Obviously, he's a really good defender and solid rebounder overall. He can guard perimeter players accurately. I think he's not necessarily a good shooter, but he doesn't necessarily have to be. But he's got good work. He does good work in the low post. He's got a nice floater that he's developed over the course of his short career. What else do you think that does he do well? And do you think it's a good investment? From everything I've seen and everything I've heard, obviously a lot of people around the league believe it's a great investment, but I want to get your take on it while we have you on air.
Yeah, I agree with that. There's no question it's a great investment. I mean, he was an absolute guarantee to get a max contract when he hit free agency this summer. Like, there was no question. He could have gotten hurt this year, and I think he still would have gotten a max contract. That's how much of a guarantee it was. Every single person that I talk to, like people who are in the position to actually give him the max contracts, are like, yeah, of course he's a max contract. Like, how are you even asking me this? Like, it's not even a discussion. Of course he's a max player. Also, like, big difference between him and Hassan Whiteside. Hassan Whiteside is 27. Steven Adams is 23.
Yeah, no, I know. You see the hair and the facial hair, and I think a lot of people tend to think, oh, this guy's older. But no, he's very, very young. Like you pointed out, his fourth year in the league, and he's only going to continue to get better.
Yeah, he's only 23 years old. Like, he's got a lot of time to improve. He's got, like you said, he doesn't shoot. He doesn't step out, you know, past the basket, which is fine. He's a five. It would be a problem if he were a four. As a five, it's fine. He's really good in the pick and roll. He's become an awesome screen setter. I really think he's one of the best screen setters in the league, not just as a ball screen guy, but he's great rolling. He's great in knowing when to slip those screens. He's a really goofy personality because he's so funny. Like, he's one of the best interviews in the league because he's so funny. But people don't realize how smart he is.
Oh, no. I mean, I do 100%. I mean, I've talked to him before. He's really, really witty and very intelligent. And you know, again, I think a lot of it's played off with the humor, but there's a real depth of perception there. He understands a lot, not just about the game, but off the floor as well. I think he's an incredibly intelligent player.
Yeah, he's a really worldly guy. And being worldly does not get you $100 million. But if you ask him about, He becomes famous for, like, the Twitter videos that I tweet out that are, like, you know, if we get Steven Adams, you know, there are going to be, like, two or three videos I'm going to tweet out, and they're going to get a gazillion retweets. Because, like, Steven Adams is responsible for, like, 80% of my Twitter followers.
Yeah.
Because I just tweet out his videos, and it's just, like, magic. Like, all of a sudden, my phone starts blowing up with notifications of just a million retweets. And because he just said something – he says something hilarious every single day. But the ones that don't get tweeted out, and maybe I should start tweeting them out, even though they're not going to blow up on Twitter, because they're just interesting for the big fans. Is that when you ask him an X's and O's question, and these are the ones that make my articles, which probably nobody reads. But if you ask him X's and O's questions, or like actual like basketball on court questions, He's the best player on the team in breaking that stuff down in a communicative way. Like, that doesn't mean that he understands it better than everybody, but he does communicate it as well as, you know, Nick Collison is great at it.
Sure.
Asking X's nose questions. Collison's great at that stuff too, which is unsurprising. But Adams is so great when you ask him just like X's nose stuff, just like, you know, really just basic, like, you know, why when you know, this happened on this play, when you guys ran this and the defense covered it this way, why did that play turn out the way that it did, or what adjustments could you have made, or whatever it was. And he gives these really, really smart and well thought out answers, and he reads his intelligence, and you see him play like that, and it's not surprising when he gives those answers considering the way he plays, because he's not just a physically adept defender. Like, he's a really smart defender with the way that he calls out, right, like the way that he calls out, you know, signals, and the way that he helps so promptly. And like, I know with like Whiteside's gotten a lot better, no question. But like, when Whiteside first came into the league, and you know, one of the reasons he took forever to jump on with the team is because like all he wanted to do was block shots.
It's funny you bring that up, because, I mean, you know, that's the matchup that I'm most curious about. I think, obviously, Goran Dragic versus Russell Westbrook is going to be an interesting one. But Whiteside, he has matured at some point. There was a game a couple nights ago against Sacramento that the Heat did win in overtime. And you could see Boogie Cousins, you know, prominently trying to goad Whiteside into losing his cool, kind of burying his head into Whiteside's chest, and being typical Boogie in that sense, being verbal and kind of goading him and trying to get him to maybe lose his cool. And in fact, it wound up being Cousins who wound up picking up six fouls in the fourth quarter, even though Whiteside was able to keep his head. He did get into foul trouble early in the game, but he was able to play his role even in overtime. So that was kind of ironic. But then conversely, the following night against the Toronto Raptors, Jonas Valanciunas completely took Whiteside away from being effective, I think. He really got into his head a little bit, and I don't know if it's just he kept him from getting, you know, good positioning near the rim. Whiteside just was not as effective as he had been early on in the season. I know it's obviously still the early on in the year, but for the first few games of the year, he was very, very effective, and not so much against Toronto and Valanciunas in particular. And then there was one play late in the game as Miami was mounting a comeback after having surrounded a big lead and coming back slowly, that he starts taking the ball up court, leading the charge there, and then he winds up colliding directly into Kyle Lowry, even though Justice Winslow was trailing alongside him. So he could have just dished the ball and gotten the easy score, and maybe Miami would have continued to build momentum. Instead, he picked up the offensive foul, and everybody's left wondering what the hell Whiteside's doing. And so it's an interesting matchup going against a guy like Adams, who's so cerebral and can and has historically always been able to get under an opponent's skin. And so you wonder whether or not he's going to be able to match what Valanciunas did and maybe just try to get Whiteside, you know, make him completely uncomfortable and get him to be far less effective than he's capable of being.
Whiteside had one of the most amazing blocks I've seen in a long time against Toronto.
Where he caught it in midair, right.
Oh my goodness. That was, for those who didn't see it, he literally, like, he made like the famous Odell Beckham Jr. catch. Like, he made that on a blocked shot with, you just reached up on it was Siakam who put up a hook shot, right? It was Siakam.
Right. Yeah.
Put up a hook shot, and Whiteside jumped up and just caught it with one hand. Yeah. It was unbelievable. It's on my Vine for people who want to see my Vine. I'll plug my Vine before it goes into Vine heaven.
Did you see the fast break dunk that he had?
Yeah, he's just a monster athletically. It's unbelievable.
That's the problem then. It's conversely where you have like a guy like, I mean, I guess maybe not Adams, but you know, maybe let's say you don't assume Adams is going to be that dominant physically, although obviously he is, you know, pretty imposing and everything else. But Whiteside's just, his athleticism is so far greater than most of the people he's playing against. But then there's always that mental aspect that I think keeps him from reaching his full potential, and has early on in his career.
Yeah, he's certainly gotten better. I mean,
sure,
there's no question. I mean, even since last year, he's certainly gotten better. There's no question about that. Like, there's a reason that he was out of the league for, you know, such a long time, and really didn't come into his own until he was like 25 years old.
Yeah. He's done a better job as far as, he's not chasing blocks. He's staying on his feet a little bit more. And his block numbers are down a little bit. Obviously, he led the league in blocks last season at almost four per game. But, you know, he's kind of a little bit more controlled as a defender. I've seen him be much more active on switching on to the roll man and pick and roll defenses. So, I mean, he's really doing a very good job in that sense. He has gotten better. So I'm glad that you pointed it out, because a lot of people in South Florida have seen it as well. But there's still those moments where he has those mental lapses. And unfortunately, you never know when they're going to take place.
So let's talk about Goran Dragic a little bit.
Let's do it.
He's been really good in five games. I haven't seen as much Heat basketball as you have, but I watched a little bit, and he looks like the third team All NBA Goran Dragic that we saw in Phoenix a few years ago.
Yeah.
Now I have a theory on why.
Okay.
And tell me if I'm right or wrong. So here's my theory. Goran Dragic, when he made third team All NBA on that team, 48 wins for Phoenix. They were the ninth seed. They barely missed the playoffs. But Dragic made third team All NBA. And his role on that team, I mean, that team wasn't supposed to be good. That was like a surprise team that Jeff Hornacek took in his first coaching season of 48. And Dragic had like all the ball handling responsibilities. And he was just able, you know, like we were talking about how Westbrook can just pound the air out of the ball. Like, same thing with Dragic.
Right.
He had that ability. Then Phoenix went out and kind of they gave more responsibilities to Eric Bledsoe in the ensuing year. They got Isaiah Thomas. The three-point guard rotation was a failure from every aspect. No one was really okay with it. They ended up having to trade Isaiah Thomas midseason. Dragic didn't really work with it. They traded him to Miami midseason. He took a little while to integrate into Miami. He was also playing next to Dwayne Wade for a year and a half in Miami, and Wade was handling the ball. And Dragic, he seems like a momentum player from possession to possession for me. And some guys are like this, where like, they need to get in the groove of handling the ball. And when they handle the ball a lot, they're a lot better at it. And one of my predictions for this year was that Goran Dragic was going to have like the year to earn the contract they gave him a couple of summers ago. And it was because like now all of a sudden the ball is going to be in Goran Dragic's hands a lot. And his numbers are way up. And I'm wondering, do you think that's a reason why?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I think a lot – you know, obviously the narrative surrounding Dwayne Wade's departure was the fact that, you know, Pat Riley may or may not have been willing to pay him. And, you know, after 13 years with the team, he clearly had defined a lot of the success they had achieved during the course of his career. But what a lot of people, you know, tend to block out was that he was not nearly as effective as he had been early on. I think there was a lot of noise about injuries and things of that sort. But even when he was on the floor for 74 games last season, he wasn't necessarily as effective as he had been. You know, he dominated the ball a lot. He slowed the pace down considerably, and that does not play towards Dragic's strengths. And so now with Wade gone, despite the fact that he's shooting three-pointers at an incredibly unexpected rate in Chicago, that was not the player that we had here in South Florida. And so, you know, Dragic now is responsible for controlling the pace and tempo of the team, and he's playing more towards his strength, pushing the pace. You see him now when Whiteside gets a rebound, they push. And that's exactly what Goran wants to do, and it's working out. And even if it's not him with the ball, if it's a guy like Waiters or Justice Winslow who's being tasked to do a lot more playmaking and facilitation on offense, I think that's really playing towards their strength. You know, Eric Spoelstra has talked about pace and space for years, and while the spacing isn't necessarily there, although it has to start the season, you expect that to kind of, you know, drop off or regress at some point as the midseason rolls around. But it's playing towards that kind of overall model there. And you're absolutely right. I think Dragic is just playing very effectively. He's shooting three-pointers at an incredible rate. You know, he's the team's best shooter from the perimeter, I think. Let me look exactly. Oh, yeah, he's shooting 57. I'm sorry. His effective overall field goal percentage is 57%, but he's shooting 54% from downtown. I mean, that's incredible. I don't expect that to be sustainable throughout the course of the year, but he's getting good looks, and he's playing well. He's happy with the ball in his hands, able to control the offense, and he's playing at that all-star level that he had achieved a couple of years ago. So I expect that to be the case throughout the year.
Who's going to guard Russell Westbrook in this game?
I think it'll be Dragic to start off there. Although I guess you could see a lot of switching between him and Waiters. Maybe Waiters will guard and get him for a little bit, and then I guess he'll switch on to Roberson. I mean, Roberson. I'm sorry, I always forget Roberson, right? Yeah, I could see that being something that happens a lot. They don't do a lot of switching as far as their defense is concerned, but then there's also the possibility that maybe Josh Richardson might start. As I mentioned to you before we started recording, he did play his first minutes of the season against Toronto. He's expected to start just because he's more of a versatile player, and I think Spoelstra likes having Waiters come off the bench for that spark offensively. So if he's starting, then obviously I think he'll get the defensive assignment of guarding Westbrook or trying to limit him as much as possible.
Is Justice Winslow guarding Russell Westbrook a possibility?
Oh yeah, I could see that. He's guarded a number of players just at the start of the season. He is versatile enough to do so. He's so physical though, and you wonder whether or not he's going to get into kind of early foul trouble. You don't want that to happen because they need him to be out on the floor and creating. Look, his shot's not falling, but you still want him to be aggressive and going to the hoop. And that's still a big part of what Miami needs him to do. So there'll be moments there where he can guard Westbrook, I think. He's quick enough, he's strong enough to be able to at least hinder him a little bit, if not necessarily defend him and shut him down.
He is so huge. Holy yeah. smokes. I saw him at Summer League and yeah. I was just like taken aback. Like I feel like a linebacker would be like blown away by his size.
You know, I feel like he almost grew in between his rookie and sophomore year there. I saw him that first Summer League when he had first gotten drafted. I'm not sure if you were there last year for that. Were you there in 2015 in Orlando for Summer League?
No, I went to Vegas that year.
Okay. So he did not look as tall in person. And then the next year, obviously, he looked significantly tall. I know he was wearing his hair up, so that might have changed my perception a little bit. But he also looked like he'd put on a significant amount of muscle weight, too. So, and he is very big, very athletic, and that's partly why they expect him to achieve greatness. You know, we haven't seen that on the offensive end, but defensively, he's been very, very solid. You know, obviously throughout his rookie year, he got some high-profile defensive assignments guarding LeBron James, Kawhi Leonard, Paul George, and James Harden. And so you expect him to, you know, continue that trend, but they need him to be much more steady offensively. The shot isn't falling, but as long as he's, you know, aggressive and going to the hoop and dishing to, you know, teammates if they're there, if he draws a double team for any reason, you know, he's got the mid-range going at a pretty decent rate. So they just want more consistency from him on the offense because they definitely need his defense on the floor.
Well, it's just his shoulders to me. Yeah. Like they're so wide. He's so thick. It's just he doesn't look like he's what, 20 years old?
Yeah, just turned 20.
Just turned 20. He does not look 20 at all. Like, that's not a 20-year-old's body. Him and Stanley Johnson, just like, those are not, like, second-year players' bodies. They're massive.
Right, yeah. Johnson in particular is even bigger, I think. But, yeah, I think Winslow's a little bit leaner, I suppose, in that sense, a little bit more long-limbed than Stanley Johnson. But, yeah, they're both really impressive up close.
It's crazy. It's crazy. You got anything else to add?
No, I mean, just the overall changes in style there. It should be a good matchup. It's an interesting test, I think, early on because, you know, we don't know exactly what to expect from this Miami team. They beat a struggling Orlando team that's going to have some problems with points. They were able to get past Sacramento once Boogie imploded a little bit. They were able to hang tight with Toronto and San Antonio, so that's a bit of a moral victory. But, again, they lost leads against both those teams, and so you don't know what to expect on a night-to-night basis, and I think that's just the way this team is going to roll out. You know, you've got an interesting mix of young players looking to establish themselves. You got a number of older veterans on short-term expiring deals like Deion's and Derek Williams, who has yet to even play, James Johnson and others. And then you've got Goran Dragic and Hassan Whiteside for the first time in his career, expected to be the guy who carries the majority of the scoring load and on defense as well. So there's going to be some inconsistency there. So I'm curious to see how they respond against a team like Oklahoma City.
Yeah. I mean, look, if you look at both of these teams, like these are both teams in transition seasons.
Oh, absolutely.
Because, you know, the Thunder lost Durant and Ibaka and Deion Waiters and Miami. They mean Dwayne Wade and Joe Johnson and Chris Bosh. And who am I forgetting? I'm forgetting someone.
Luol Deng,
thank you. Like, those are consequential players from a team that almost made the Eastern Conference Finals last year.
Sure.
So, I mean, these are two teams, you know, one that made the Conference Finals and one that came one win away from the Conference Finals and lost major parts of their teams. And I think they were both kind of, you know, we could speculate on what they were going to be, but they were both kind of unknowns coming into this year. So it's almost like a test game for both of them.
Absolutely. Yeah, and you know, before I forget – I meant to bring it up, but you've got Domantas Sabonis starting at the power forward position. And the power forward spot has been one of obvious weakness for Miami. They have Luke Babbitt starting. You know, obviously, he's a very one-dimensional player. You probably saw a lot of him in New Orleans last season. He's out there to shoot, space the floor a little bit, but he doesn't do anything else particularly well or well at all. So that's an interesting one there. But what have you seen from Sabonis so far in his rookie season?
He looks like a rookie.
Okay.
He looks like a rookie. I mean, there are some he's getting into foul trouble. He's fouling, yeah. He's fouling jump shooters. He's reaching. He's really getting any kind of foul, which is fine. I mean, look, I always say it's okay for a rookie to look like a rookie. You've got a problem when like a fifth year player looks like a rookie.
Yeah, good point.
When a guy on his sixth or seventh career game looks like a rookie, like that's cool. He is a rookie. You're allowed to look like a rookie. Like some people bashed Cameron Payne last year for, you know, being inconsistent and, you know, making bad decisions and looking inexperienced. Like, no, Cameron Payne has good ability when he gets on the court. Like he has good ability. He's just a rookie who's playing like a rookie. And Billy Donovan has stuck with Sabonis in the starting lineup. He's started every game so far. He started every preseason game too. That doesn't necessarily mean he's played a lot of minutes. Like there was one game, I think it was the Lakers game last Sunday, about a week ago, when he played 7 minutes and then he never actually went back into the game after that. So it's not like he's playing a ton of minutes. I don't think he's played more than 17 or 18. And he's looked a little better the last couple of games, I thought. He's a good passer. Like I think he's going to be a good player.
Yeah.
He's a good passer. He looks like he's going to be able to shoot three at a decent rate. He's got a little bit of a handle. He's so left-hand dominant. He is so left-hand dominant. And defenders are playing him to go left now, and they are just giving him his right. And when I talk about left-hand dominant, like I'm not even saying like he doesn't even pass the ball from his right side. Defenders are just giving him the right, and he is coming back to the left every time. And now he's getting blocked a lot in those scenarios. He's turning the ball over. He's losing balance because defenders are just overloading on the side that is completely his dominant side. So, you know, if he wants to do anything, he's got to find a way to really even out. Look, realistically, his right hand's never going to be as good as his left, but he's got to find a way to at least develop a right hand to where he can at least pass from the right side, because they're just absolutely giving him the right side every single time now with defenders are in, and it's become a problem where he's just kind of unable to operate when a defender goes that extreme. And I think we're going to start seeing it to an even more extreme degree once defenders really like face him a second time and remember every time, because you know defenders go through habits. You know, it's like their coaches are telling him he's left hand dominant, don't give him the left, just give him the right all you want, he's not going to take it. And sometimes you just forget, maybe on a singular possession, maybe throughout a game, like you just forget it because you go into your usual habits. And when you face a guy a second time, it's easier to remember that stuff. So if he doesn't develop that right, yeah, I think it's going to progressively become more and more of a problem throughout the year, because you know, certain defenders on one play, they'll give him their left. You know, they'll give him his right. And on the next play, they'll just man him up like he's a normal guy, forgetting he's a lefty. He's a work in progress for sure, but I think he'll be a good player. He does a lot of stuff well, and I think he'll hone those skills and become a pretty good pick and pop guy, a smart, good team. Never going to be like a shot blocker or anything, but like he's really bright, so he'll be a good team defender, and he's got pretty quick feet, so he'll be a good team defender, a good pick and roll defender, a guy who could switch a little bit on defense. Like I think he'll be a really solid power forward.
Do you expect Grant to supplant him as a starter or play considerable minutes, you know, if he gets yanked early for a foul trouble or anything like that?
I think that's possible. I mean, Billy Donovan is like so flexible about his rotations and like so open about how flexible he is with his rotations. So I think any change is possible. Now, I don't know if Billy is necessarily going to yank Sabonis like right away, but I think anything down the line is possible. Like, sure, Grant could do it. Laverne could do it. I don't think Canner will ever start next to Adams because there are some lineups where that just doesn't work.
Sure.
But so I don't think he'll ever be a consistent starter. But like Laverne could. Grant could. Like, these are possibilities depending on what happens with Sabonis. I also think it's possible Sabonis gets better because, again, dude's a rookie and rookies get better. So, you know, we'll see.
Well, that's all I've got, man. Thanks for taking the time and for joining us to preview tomorrow night's matchup. All right. Or tonight's matchup.
Yeah. Anything to plug?
No, you can find all my writing. I've got a few pieces coming out for different sites. I contribute all over, but the best way to follow that is to follow me on Twitter at DRamil13 and to follow our show, Locked On Heat. That's where you get it, on Twitter with my co-host, Wes Goldberg.
Great. Locked On Heat's really good. All part of the Locked On Podcast Network, on every night, just like I am, or every weeknight, week morning. When do you guys usually release yours?
We started posting them at night now so that we can get our listeners, especially now that we're doing more nightly recaps. It's better to get that content fresh out there after the game.
Nice. Perfect. So you can listen to them every, you know, we'll call it every day, Monday through Friday. It's, you know, it's the lockdown model. Remember, I'm on every day also, Monday through Friday, and you can head on to iTunes and subscribe to either of our shows or wherever else you listen to podcasts. If you have questions or comments, email lockdownthunder@gmail.com, or you can just find me on Twitter. Go straight to the source, at Fred Katz, FREDKATZ. You can also log on to normantranscript.com for all your Thunder needs and check out Thunder Road. That's my blog there. It's under the sports tab on the site, and you can follow team coverage and what's next for the Thunder. That's going to do it for today. Thanks to David for coming on. Back with you tomorrow for more Thunder talk, wrap up with the Heat game, all that stuff. Until then, Locked On Thunder is locking up.